Hello and welcome. This is an audio recording of an IFG live event.
Hello and welcome to this Institute for Government Net Zero bonus podcast. My name's Tom Sass. I'm an associate director at the IFG. So there we have it. 838 days after the UK first adopted its world-leading net zero target, 11 months after the Treasury's interim net zero review, and seemingly several aeons after a minister at the Bays Department first said the heat and building strategy was imminent, all three big government climate reports were published on Tuesday, along with a bounty of other documents, some 2,000 plus pages for climate, energy and government watchers to chew through. The UK government has set its stall out on net zero, with 2 weeks to go before the presidential jets touch down in Glasgow. But was it worth the wait? Do the plans stack up? Can they be delivered? And has the Treasury answered the question of how to pay for it? I'm joined by three top experts, IFG Senior Fellow Jill Rutter. Hi, Jill.
Hello, Tom.
Dr. Will McDowell, IFG Associate and Associate Professor at UCL and our resident expert on energy policy. Hi, Will.
Hi, Tom.
And delighted to have as our guest, James Murray, Editor-in-Chief at Business Green and all-round climate sage. Hello, James.
Hi.
So let's start with the net zero strategy. This is the central document which tries to set out how every sector of the UK economy will approach the transition over the next 30 years. James, you've written a great piece for your website on this, which concludes that it's not glass half full quite yet, but the glass is filling up. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's definitely too early to get the banners out and say this is job done by any stretch of the imagination. I think sometimes you get the impression the Prime Minister wants to declare mission accomplished on this stuff. And it's, you know, we really are at the beginnings of a 30-year long journey. And you do always have to go back to the fact that global emissions are still rising. The hope that they peaked ahead of the pandemic seems to have been a bit short-lived, and it looks like they're going to keep climbing for a little while yet as the economic recovery takes pace. So we're still such a long way from bending the curve down that I'm always reluctant to say anything's glass half full in the climate sphere when you look at it in that context. And that's the context that Greta Thunberg and others constantly point out, how badly we're doing against many of the metrics that we've set ourselves and indeed the epic challenges that we're going to face as climate impacts escalate. So it's definitely not glass half full, but it is significant and real progress. And the thing I sort of went back to in that piece, and I go back to time and time again, is that all of this stuff flows from the Paris Agreement, which was only 6 years ago. And the whole idea of the net zero economy was sort of embedded within that document. It wasn't really noticed much at the time, but it was there in this idea that we balance anthropogenic emissions in the second half of the century. And the sort of the diplomats who managed to get that into that text, if you told them that less than, you know, 6 years later, you would have two thirds of the global economy with net zero targets in place, one of the world's leading economies in the UK with a legally binding target, and now a really pretty credible strategy for delivering on it, particularly in the sort of medium term, they'd have been astounded that this thinking would have become so embedded in business leaders and political leaders. So we're seeing serious progress, and the plan is progress. There's lots of good stuff in there. It is going to catalyse the heat pump market. It is going to catalyse the EV market. It does send a signal that we're going to build more big low carbon infrastructure, whether it's nuclear or carbon capture and storage. There's lots of really positive things in there that over the next decade should start to bend the emissions curve down faster and crucially provide a template for other countries to follow so that hopefully those global emissions start to peak.
Yeah, easy to forget how far we've come. You're quite right. What were the biggest gaps for you, though?
There were quite a few. There's absolutely glaring omission on behaviour change. The plan says, and the government said repeatedly, we want to work with the grain of human behaviour, and we don't want to challenge that too much. And they seem to think that to talk about behaviour change at all is to tell everyone you can never eat steak again and you must sell your car immediately, which is, of course, a nonsense. What people are talking about is simply laying the groundwork for these changes by talking a little bit more proactively about sensible choices and trying to curb emissions a bit in the the day-to-day decisions that we make, much as they do with health, much as they do with many other areas. So that was completely missing. There were other things that were kind of included but were underfunded. So the energy efficiency funding is still well short of what many people think is required, even though energy efficiency funding is shown to deliver massive economic stimulus and is the most cost-effective way of curbing emissions. There simply, you know, there wasn't the fiscal firepower from the Treasury on a lot of the key stuff, energy efficiency being a key one, nature protection and natural carbon sinks being another. And there was still a lot of detail TBC. So, you know, the government said it's going to do carbon capture and storage, these industrial hubs. It said it's going to do new nuclear. But the actual nitty-gritty of how you do that, the impact on bills and many other issues are yet to be resolved. So, as with everything that ever happens in government, this will just now kick off another cycle of consultations and calls for evidence to put in place the framework to actually drive those areas forward. And you could go on and on. I mean, you know, the cycling lobby weren't particularly happy. There wasn't really enough on sort of active transport. There wasn't enough, as I say, on nature. And you know, we're still going to keep burning peatland. You could, in that piece, I did have a very long paragraph of things that you could criticise.
Yeah. Well, James has mentioned there, you know, list of things that were missing, but also the fact that behaviour change as a whole was underplayed. On the other hand, it was a strategy which seemed to set out a sort of pretty heavy reliance on technology innovation. Did you think that was credible and realistic, or is it sort of techno-optimism?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, clearly, technological change has made huge strides in our capacity to even consider net zero, you know, on a 2050 time span over the past decade. You know, the cost reductions that we've seen and the progress that we've seen in electric vehicles, in solar, in wind, in batteries, they've completely transformed the landscape for all of this. So I can see that, you know, a techno-optimistic view is, well, it's clearly there in what the government's saying. So there's real increased ambition around carbon capture and storage. Quite bold goals for heat pump cost reductions that many in the industry are thinking are, you know, that's perhaps a little bit too optimistic. So I think there's real risks here for the way that the government is depending on technologies to do all the heavy lifting rather than some of the behavior change, some of the price incentives, some of the regulatory things that that we might expect. And, you know, it's understandable why they're doing that. Clearly, it's nice to be able to talk about flashy new technologies and to talk about jet zero rather than telling people that they might need to fly less. But I think it may be short-sighted and high risk if we're not really delivering those technologies. And on CCS in particular, you know, we've raised the ambition, seen the ambition raised in this document, 50% on what the Prime Minister said last year in his 10-point plan. Last year, it was 20 million tonnes of carbon stored by 2030. Now it's 30 million tonnes. You know, that's a huge increase for a technology that, you know, has never anywhere demonstrated that it can be deployed at scale at a cost that's reasonable. So I think, yes, there's a lot of techno-optimism in this document, and that's a major risk for the strategy as a whole.
Mm. And Jill, I mean, should we worry about that, this sort of gap between the sort of ambition in the document and the policy detail, because there's a sort of think that some of these technologies might come and save us?
I think we should, but I wanted to just as a sort of bit of a veteran of previous strategies, going back to the ill-fated climate change program review under the Tony Blair government, I do think we ought to mark what's really different about this strategy, which I do think sort of underlines a bit of the cause for optimism. What we've seen before, and we saw even until the sort of 2017 clean growth strategy, was that these strategies were run by quite a weak department, whether it was DEFRA in the Climate Change Programme Review or the Business Department. They tended to see quite a lot of action where those departments had the levers, but absolutely nothing much else from the rest of government. And they were sort of very bitsy collections of micro initiatives. What I think is really important on this this strategy is it takes a very different starting point. I mean, it follows, if you like, the Climate Change Committee's framework of working out, you know, if we are going to decarbonize these sectors, these are the gaps we need to have policy measures to fill in. So while you're absolutely right that the government is making some big bets on new technologies, and it's making big bets that new technologies will come in and be deployed at scale in very quick timescales. There's some quite interesting diagrams where you see a little bit of activity to 2025, quite a big step up 2025 to 2030, mm-hmm. and then suddenly a lot of dots where the dots represent activity 2030, 2035, and 2035 mm-hmm. to 2040. And that tends to be what you get in government, where you're slightly hopeful that things will happen, but you're not necessarily that confident. But because they're taking this filling in the gaps and working back from what's needed approach, it does mean, it means particularly when they let us see, you know, all the assumptions underlying their projections, that they can be held to account for what's going on. And potentially, if some measures aren't coming through, they may need to change course and rely much more on some of these more tried and tested techniques, like, dare I say it, some demand management and some behaviour change. I think this is very much a sort of Boris Johnson strategy. He said to the UN General Assembly that Kermit was right. It was not right. It's easy being green. It's not that easy being green. But what he's trying to offer is a sort of optimistic, sort of Boris-esque, pain-free, and I think crucially, word they use about sustainable aviation fuel, sort of guilt-free transition, that this is a transition that actually isn't going to cost you too much, we hope, isn't going to inconvenience you too much, which I think is a bit worrying, because there are some areas there where the government really possibly needs to have a bit more honest conversation with the public.
Mm. And James, Jill mentioned there the ability to hold the government to account on some of what it's set out in this strategy. There's been a bit of some criticism from NGOs and others about a lack of transparency on exactly what the kind of emissions reductions are from different policy commitments and how it all adds up, and whether we should just take Bayes's word for that. Is that something you think we should be worried about?
It depends on how you look at it. I mean, firstly, yes. I mean, there's an obvious concern there, particularly for the NGO and campaigning world, that the government doesn't seem to have shown it's working on exactly how this adds up. And that will fuel the concerns that it might not get to the compliance with the carbon budgets that we need to see. And that actually speaks a little bit to Jill's point of that a lot of this is based on the technology coming good. And, you know, that's probably less certain than if you were just saying, okay, we are going to, you know, improve the energy efficiency of X million homes. And we know pretty sure, we can model that pretty certainly, that that's going to reduce emissions. You know, saying that this particular technology will cost X by this particular date, and therefore the market will then do Y, that's much harder to model, and therefore, you know, there's probably less certainty in that, and that probably partly explains why they haven't come through with the full details of the working. So there is a sort of transparency issue there. I'm also always a little bit more relaxed on this than some of my colleagues in this space, though, because it's always a slightly ridiculous exercise, isn't it? I mean, who knows what the idea that anyone knows precisely what the net zero emission economy looks like in 2050, or indeed in 2030, is for the birds. I mean, I know why governments have to do this and businesses have to plan ahead in this way, but there is so much uncertainty here in how it pans out, in you know, the level of cost, the different technology mix, the paths, and the level of emission reduction versus, you know, offsets that we use, mitigation. I mean, it is impossible to model in any real, serious, absolutely firm sense. That doesn't mean we know we have to do it. I mean, that's absolutely clear, but it's very difficult to come out with absolute certainty to say, well, this is what it's going to look like. This is just a guide. And I do think the report generally does a pretty good sense of, okay, this is our preferred path.
Yeah. And Jill, just finally for this section on the overarching strategy, I mean, we've written quite a bit about governance and actually how government might need to change to deliver all of this. There was a chapter in that on the report. It talked about the Climate Cabinet Committees, the delivery unit, and so on. Were you persuaded by what they had to say there?
Not quite yet. I think, I mean, we've pointed to some useful things. We've got these two climate committees and the government's adopting this structure that it adopted for Brexit and indeed COVID of having a strategy committee chaired by the Prime Minister. I think the question there is how often does that actually meet? Quite a small, tight committee, and then a much bigger committee that currently is chaired by Alok Sharma. Whether that persists beyond the COP is quite interesting, that is responsible for actual delivery. And this is now sorted up, and there's a bit more apparatus than there was when we wrote that report to support delivery in the shape of this being one of the Prime Minister's four priorities that is being taken forward by the number 10 delivery unit. So that bit is good, and allegedly the subject of regular stock takes. So that bit is good. The good thing is the government has said it will publish annual updates on how it's doing. I think it's quite important that the Committee on Climate Change is going to review those. It might even be better if that review was not done by government itself, but is done by the Climate Change Committee to say, is the government actually meeting its objectives? There's going to be progress reporting. I think the question is, and I think this goes very much to some of these things, if everything goes right and all these bets come off, then maybe it's okay to have somebody like Alok Sharma or maybe Kwasi Kwarteng in the future chairing the committee, although that committee will be also wanting to interrogate progress by the business department, which makes it a bit of a conflict of interest if it's that Secretary of State. But if those bets aren't coming off and there needs to be a question going around the table again of, well, we're not on track, what are we going to do differently? Who else is going to do what? Who's going to step up? Questions like that. How are we getting this back on track? That's where you need some real force there, both, I think, on the policy side, but also some political clout to say, actually, this really does matter. You're going to have to reprioritize within your department, put more effort in. And that's where really, ultimately, it's only back to the Prime Minister or a very powerful surrogate. We'd suggested before, this was pre the reshuffle, that a sort of a powerful cabinet office minister like Michael Gove might be the person to do that for the Prime Minister, because it's quite detailed work. I'm not yet convinced that the government is right to have gone ahead with existing structures rather than create a more central net zero unit in the cabinet office.
Okay, so wait and see on that one. Okay, so one of the centerpieces of what came out this week was the big plan on heat and buildings, as we've been discussing. You know, there's a plan for scaling up heat pumps as well as energy efficiency. And we know that this is one of the trickiest areas of the whole transition. Will, you've had a thorough read of that heat and building strategy. Do you think the government has a credible plan here on both the sort of clean heat side and on energy efficiency?
I think there's a kind of a game of two halves. I think it's much stronger on heat than on efficiency. I think you're quite right that it's one of the trickiest challenges economically, politically, in terms of behaviour. And the heat and building strategy really does start to grapple with the full range of problems and the full range of issues that it needs to. And so from that perspective, it's an impressive piece of work and it's an impressive kind of array of issues. Lots of details are still to be worked out, though. I mean, I think we've said that about everything so far. And I think that really speaks to the scope of the net zero transition that, you know, 2 days after the government's published more than 2,000 pages of very detailed strategy and analysis and documentation, we're all still saying, but where are the details? And that just speaks to the depth of complexity of this transition. I think the strategy has some real strengths on the heat side, on particularly a broadly credible approach to the deployment of heat pumps, which has been a really important gap. Heat pumps and hydrogen are really the two main options for decarbonizing heat. Government in the summer published a pretty credible strategy on hydrogen to bring that technology forward to enable a decision to be made strategically in the mid-2020s on whether to go down that route. And it really needed to do something on heat pumps if it wasn't making a hydrogen decision by default. And it's done that. So we've got a clear set of regulatory rules and a proposed new market-based mechanism to drive the adoption of heat pumps. But there's very little detail about how that market-based mechanism will work. Most of the headlines have been about the £5,000, it's now called a boiler upgrade scheme, which is just a subsidy to install a heat pump. But actually, that's really not not hugely relevant in terms of transforming the market. It's only for 3 years and it'll keep deployment rates much as they've been. The market-based mechanism is the really big story, but the details just aren't there. So that will be really important to see. And as James said earlier, the strategy's been very weak on efficiency, and there's really nothing on the owner-occupied sector. People who own their own homes need to improve the efficiency of homes, and yet there's very little in the strategy to see how that's going to happen. So I think that's a real shortcoming and something that the government is going to have to revisit over the coming years, because it's clear that driving energy efficiency more effectively is a really important and necessary part of a credible net zero transition.
James, Will's mentioned some of the sort of lack of certainty there in what the government set out. And we know that there's lots of businesses in the sort of supplier space when it comes to homes decarbonisation who feel that they've been quite burned by previous government policy failures, whether that's the Green Homes Grant or the Green Deal. What are the sort of businesses that you talk to making of this latest set of announcements? Are they kind of pleased with what's in the heat and building strategy?
I think they're broadly pretty happy, to be honest. I mean, the government did a very good job of lining up a lot of supportive quotes around the announcement. So basically all the energy majors were there saying, this is great, this is a good step forward, and significant progress. A lot of the trade groups were very supportive as well. I think there was a general sort of feeling that this is quite a pro-business strategy, and it was broadly welcomed. I think in private, all the sort of cavils that we've already gone through are there. There is a bit of concern about the level of funding. There's certainly concern about the skills gap, whether they are going to be able to find enough skilled people to deploy these technologies. There's definitely concern about, like I say, the energy efficiency side of things, because obviously heat pumps tend to work best in the most efficient homes. So the lack of action on that front is slightly concerning. There's also Citizens Advice, interestingly, have just had a report out saying the consumer protection's just not great either. This is a new area, and if you don't get the consumer protection right, you're going to see cowboy operators and scams. And of course, they harm confidence in the market and they harm the legitimate operators, just as they harm the consumer. So there's work to be done there. So there's areas that I think they want to see more progress, and they want that long-term vision of, what is the market mechanism of getting this stuff out. Where they're being positive, though, and I think they're right to be positive, is that it's the government, in a way, has sort of laid down the gauntlet on heat pumps. There was the lobbying battle as to whether it would be heat pumps or hydrogen, and the government's come down pretty firmly on the side of heat pumps, certainly in the short to medium term. They'll look again at hydrogen. They're not ruling it out, but heat pumps are the only game in town now for the next coming sort of 4 or 5 years or so. And the gauntlet's being firmly laid down to these companies and saying, if you can produce a technology that works and that is lower cost, that can match up against a boiler, we'll back you. We'll make the transition of the levies on energy bills to make it more cost effective still. We'll help phase out boilers so that you become the default technology. And businesses and entrepreneurs, particularly the confident ones, they like that sort of thing. And it's interesting, the model the government's always going back to is what happened with offshore wind, where they said, bring the costs down, we'll back you, and you can become the backbone of the energy system. And the offshore wind developers and the engineers and the investors, they went out there, they innovated, they absolutely slashed the cost, and now offshore wind is on track to be the backbone of the energy system. It's the same thing we're seeing with electric vehicles, the same thing we're seeing with heat pumps. And most businesses like that certainty, and they like that challenge. They like going away and innovating and trying to win market share. There's concerns, but there was a broad sense of this is really welcome, arguably pretty long overdue, but now we can go out and deliver.
And Jill, just briefly, a word on the sort of politics of this, because this was clearly the one area that the government was most worried about. Do you think this sort of steady, cautious type of approach is actually quite sensible?
I think the fact that the Prime Minister was so clear he wanted to avoid the headlines and his words about the boiler police won't be coming in at Carrant Point to remove your beloved Cumbie boiler, I think was quite important for the government to say, we're not actually forcing you to rip this out. I think it's really interesting that part of their growing the market, and actually quite a big slug of their deployment, will be in new build. And the sort of, you know, people who don't have gas boilers now, the off-gas grid people. So they've sort of gone into a part of the market that actually people are buying new things. And I think the really interesting thing there on the skills side, I'd be very interested if James or Will have a view, is to some extent that will sort of put the burden on the volume house builders to skill up that market, because they'll need to be deploying heat pumps at scale in their new build to meet that requirement that they don't put gas boilers in houses after the mid-2020s. So I think it's really interesting. I think that probably is a sensible approach, because I think this was an area where the government clearly was very worried about very bad headlines that, you know, it's hugely expensive, you will be colder. And that, of course, is the criticism as well that is being made by Steve Baker and his colleagues in the Net Zero Scrutiny Group, that you are asking my constituents to pay more to freeze. And that's not a very palatable political proposition. Mm.
Okay, and that brings us on to the last in this sort of trio of big government documents that came out on Tuesday, and that was the Treasury's Net Zero Review, looking at the costs of net zero and who should pay. Jill, lots of sort of journalists have run with the line of Rishi Sunak sort of undercutting some of the Johnsonian optimism that we've been talking about. Do you think that's right? And what did the review sort of really tell us about the Treasury's thinking?
Well, my first reading of it, I thought it read a bit like it was written by a bunch of sulky teenagers who were a bit annoyed to be asked to do this. But when I put that to the Treasury, they thought, oh, it's a bit unfair. I think, you know, there are good sides to it from a net zero point of view. The Treasury does point out that there are benefits from tackling climate change. It actually puts quite a big figure on co-benefits, which I think is quite important for the Treasury to be acknowledging, particularly in areas like air quality. But it's notably less positive on some of the benefits that the Prime Minister likes to claim from net zero. Notably, it points out that just because it's a net zero investment doesn't mean it gives you this massive productivity boost. It points out that things like carbon capture and storage actually offers nothing really on productivity at all. It's, you know, a bit lukewarm on green jobs. There's no necessary productivity gain then from changing somebody who fits gas central heating into somebody who fits a heat pump. So I think it's more downbeat in that sense. What it does, and a lot of the background briefing made very clear, is the Treasury is warning that this is not a cost-free changeover. This will cost money. And of course, the Treasury has come in with this line, which bits of the document seem to be slightly contradictory, but the line that they aren't going to make a sort of net zero exception to their fiscal rules. So you can borrow for net zero, but they're not going to have a laxer fiscal rule because it's a net zero transition. So it's not going to be treated like pandemic spending or war spending as something where it's legitimate to take that on public borrowing and sort of run that off over time. And that's partly because they're really worried about the structural challenges to the public finances in the long run. I also think they're actually probably quite worried about the Prime Minister's propensity to spend public money with abandon in the short run.
And Rishi Sunak's been pushing this green savings bond, which the Treasury has brought forward, and potentially some of that money could be funneled into net zero investment.
Yeah, they've brought out a national savings bond, which some people are saying is actually at a better rate than the market rate. But the Treasury, I think, has also been issuing, it's now issued, I think, £16 billion worth in the last couple of months of green gilts. And those green gilts have been sold at a discount to normal government debt, so cheaper for the government. But actually, it's really interesting because if you read what the Treasury says, which says basically we'll have to contain all this within what we'd have borrowed anyway. So basically, it's net zero capital spending versus schools capital or hospital capital or whatever else you want to spend your capital budget on. There's no real reason why, as an investor, I should go in and say, well, yippity-dippity, I'm happy to take a lower interest rate because it's got a bit of green labelling on it. So good news, of course, for the taxpayer in the long run, if you can fool some of those investors, but it's not necessarily a great deal. But the other thing, of course, that the Treasury Review does start to dip a toe in the water on is costs. I mean, it makes it clear that the government's preference is not carbon taxation, as some people have recommended, but is to use and extend the UK emissions trading scheme to have a rising carbon price there, that some of the revenues for that will be used to offset the temporary costs of transition. And that makes sense because you've got temporary revenues. You don't want to build that in to the tax base long term. It's launched what it calls a call for evidence on fairness and affordability, which is code for at some point we need to rebalance the tax treatment of gas and electricity, but we're not going to do it against the backdrop of soaring gas prices. We're not that politically cloth-eared. And finally, and I think counterproductively, they've pointed to the inevitable that motoring taxes on fossil fuel duties, etc., will drop off a cliff when we have large-scale switch over to electric vehicles. But they've absolutely ducked any sense of starting a debate of how they might fill that gap. And in particular, the two words road pricing, notably absent from the transport decarbonisation strategy, have not been mentioned in the Treasury document either. And I think that the Treasury does need to start getting out the heavy roller on the pitch for that one, because otherwise it'll find itself with people enjoying low tax, tax-free almost motoring with their EV, and then suddenly the government comes in through the other door with saying, oh my God, we've just discarded £30 billion of tax revenue. We need to put other taxes up.
James, the big dividing line I think that's emerging here, certainly between the Conservatives and Labour, is really about the level of public investment, or indeed between, you know, perhaps between the Treasury and Number 10 as well. We've seen, not a huge amount of new public investment in this net zero strategy published this week, whereas Labour calling for a much larger sort of $28 billion a year to the end of the decade. Do you think the government and indeed the Treasury sort of made a credible argument in the strategy and in the various documents sort of in favour of that approach of leaving most of this to the private sector?
I think they probably have. I mean, it depends where you sit on the political spectrum. It's very much a kind of, this is the net zero strategy for a centre-right, vaguely populist government, and Labour has the net zero strategy for kind of a centre-left, slightly different flavour of populist government. I mean, they are doing almost exactly what you'd expect. The thing is, there are risks with both sides, and the big risk with the path the government is taking is, is there enough seed capital there? Are they really catalyzing in the right areas to drive the pace of change that we need? Because this is the thing that is forgotten so often with this is, we are on the clock here. We genuinely need a fully transformational decade, which in terms of business decision making and investment cycles is sort of one cycle, if that. So the question is, are they providing the sufficient levels to really catalyze the scale of change that we need? And if they do duck some of those conversations with the public, can you sort of do that indefinitely? Can this all be kind of guilt-free and low impact? Now, I think there's some justification in that argument. There's a lot more that can be done that is popular with the public, wouldn't really impinge upon people's lives to a great deal. But the question is, a little bit of political leadership here probably could drive faster progress, because there is a large majority of the public who say they're concerned about these issues, who want to find out more, who want to do more. And there's a need to kind of get ahead of it. The other thing that's important, I think, that the sort of centre-right approach to this gets is some of this stuff just, the costs do need socialising. And it does need a degree of organisation. I mean, the big one that I worry about a lot at the moment is the electric vehicle charging network, where we're seeing investment flood into electric vehicle charging, but it is very ad hoc and messy. We're not necessarily seeing chargers in the right places. We're seeing myriad different networks that often aren't particularly compatible. And people, talk to an electric vehicle driver and they've got like 20 different apps on their phone for the different charging experience that they want, and demand for those EVs is soaring. And, there were lots of stories this summer of people getting to service stations and having to wait for an hour for a charge point because there weren't sufficient charge points. Now, the market isn't delivering fast enough there. And I know the government is putting some money into this, but that really does need fixing, because if it doesn't, you are going to start to undermine the pace at which people want to switch to electric vehicles. And then that undermines your entire road transport decarbonisation strategy. Again, we keep going back to it. Same with energy efficiency. You know, that is a market failure. There's millions and millions of households that can't afford the upgrades. There's millions and millions of landlords that aren't providing particularly warm homes to their tenants. And that does need regulation and policy and investment. And the sort of slightly light touch approach isn't necessarily going to deliver that progress as quickly as we need to see it. So there's merits on both sides of this kind of this economic argument, but that, you know, a typical boring centrist answer, but you know, we do need a more sort of radical centrist approach that takes the best of both of those models. And I think that probably would look like a bit more public investment, but with due respect for how do we catalyze the private sector to innovate and do what it does well.
Tom, coming in there, I think the one thing that the private sector does need, and this does, I think, go to the sort of issue of party competition, is it does need degrees of certainty that the government will stick to these timetables and it won't reverse, because that's what I think we've seen in the past that has been very damaging, that the government's put something out there and then changes its mind. And that if you've then been banking on the government sticking with that commitment, you discover you've wasted scarce resources in getting ready for something that doesn't happen. Yeah. I think at least political agreement on the timetables and deadlines, that these are at least the sort of minimum that will be observed, would be very helpful.
And that's one of the big political risks here, is that it's been very notable to anyone watching this stuff that the two most likely successors to Boris Johnson in Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss are lukewarm to the point of tepid in their public pronouncements on these issues. And that for long-term investors and though is a slight concern, is that it doesn't feel as embedded as it should be yet in the top ranks of the Conservative government, and particularly those two prospective next leaders.
Really interesting point. And just briefly, James, we talked a bit throughout the podcast about the sort of affordability issues, which are obviously getting a lot of play in the newspapers, some fairly hysterical reporting about the sort of costs that poor households might be forced to bear, whether that's on sort of new heat pumps or electric vehicles and so on. And do you think the government did enough this week to kind of reassure particularly some of those on the back benches, you know, some of the Sun and those sort of newspapers, about the affordability of this transition for people?
I think they did a good job of probably reassuring the wider public. I thought the message that, you know, this isn't happening overnight and that we are going to bring the costs down was quite clear. And I think most people will get that. It won't in any way convince the certain backbenchers that are opposed to this, because they are opposed to this on ideological grounds. No matter how often they keep saying they're just worried about the cost, look closely at their pronouncements on climate science, on their connections to the Global Warming Policy Foundation, on their complete failure to come forward with an alternative plan for getting to net zero that there would be lower cost. They're not interested in having that debate. This is purely a big ideological and, I'd argue, even anti-science opposition to anything to do with climate action, is my view. And I don't think there's anything the government can say that is going to convince them otherwise. Which I think is a big concern, because I think that argument and that lobbying is just not going to go away. And no matter how often you say, look, this is detached from reality, we are not going to suddenly hit people with thousands and thousands of pounds of new bills. We are not going to force them to change to technologies that aren't proven and cost competitive. They're just going to continue to pump away the scare stories. I've made the point before. I mean, a lot of them are from kind of the pro-Brexit camp, and it's on this, why are you touting this Project Fear and why are you talking Britain down, which is exactly what they're doing.
And interesting with your point about the next leadership election. Will, just finally on this, so you mentioned some of the sort of lack of funding for energy efficiency, but if you look sort of more broadly across the piece, and I know you do a lot of work looking at energy and innovation policy more widely, do you think there's enough support for the policies, some of the new policies that were coming forward, whether that's nuclear, CCS, other areas?
I think, on energy innovation, government's been talking a lot about its energy innovation program, 1.5 billion over the next few years on a whole wide range of net zero technologies. And I think that's absolutely necessary. And we've seen over the last 15 years, successive governments increasing the amount that governments are spending on R&D, because historically the UK really didn't spend enough on energy technologies at all, compared either with the scale of the challenge or with comparator countries. So there's been a real increase in energy R&D spending, and that's been absolutely necessary and will be really important. I think there are, though, big questions about the scale of funding for some of those more difficult to achieve things. I mean, we've talked about efficiency. You know, innovation isn't just about R&D in the lab. Driving a program of efficiency in the built environment would generate lots of innovation that would bring costs down, enable standardization, new business models, et cetera. It's not just all about the lab. And on CCS, again, I mean, I think, you know, that's a technology that, you know, you really need to have a long-term strategic plan with the money to back it up if you're going to make that happen. I think on some areas like hydrogen, I think government has put together a plan and funding package that does broadly make sense and does push things forward in a sequenced way that offers a clear technology roadmap. In other areas, I think there are still some pretty big gaps.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for. All those net zero pages rattled through in just over 40 minutes. How's that for efficiency? My thanks to Jill Rutter, Will McDowell and James Murray. Great that you could all join us. And thank you all for listening. Do check out our website, instituteforgovernment.org.uk, for all our latest net zero work, some blogs up there responding to the latest strategies this week. And do subscribe to both our podcast channels, Inside Briefing and IFG Live. You can listen on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. The budget and spending review are next. We've got a couple of special podcasts lined up. COP26 follows soon after. We'll be keeping a close eye on that, and we'll have lots more to say about the government's net zero policy. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you've enjoyed this edition of IFG Live. Please do subscribe to hear more. And if you'd like to know about our upcoming events, please visit instituteforgovernment.org.uk/events.